If you've lived in the country, you know that rabbits are a pest. And often people go out rabbit shooting to get rid of the pests, or they'll do other things. Sometimes in the country, teenage kids will go rabbit chasing. And that involves no guns, no dogs, just kids chasing rabbits. And so one day I was visiting my in-laws, my uncle and aunt, who owned a property at Mungindi, just outside of Moree. And they said after dinner, why don't we do some rabbit chasing? And so my mate and I from the city, Spike and I, we thought, well, we're in. We were 13. Why not? So we go out and rabbit chasing, they still run around in utilities. It's dark. There's a spotlight or a spotlighter from the top of the ute showing out the light. You're looking for rabbits because it's plague proportions. They're all over the place. And when you saw a rabbit or a small plague of rabbits, you jump out of the utility and chase them. Rabbits would scatter everywhere. Like initially they're blinded by the lights and they're mesmerised and they sit still, but then they're shaken out of it and they take off and you just chase them. They go up hollow logs and we pick up the logs and bounce them up. This is anyone here from the RSPCA, do this. Shake the logs, you know, chase them. And when you caught them, they cap around a bit and then you throw them in a big sugar bag, a Hessian bag, and stick them in the back of the truck. And we just went for that for hours and hours and hours. One time I was chasing one of these rabbits on this particular night. I was fleet of foot at one stage, so I was catching a rabbit as it was taken off, and it bounced all over the place, running around tufts of grass and stuff, and I thought, okay, I'll follow you. And then at one point it jumped up and went over something, and I thought, okay, jump. So I jumped, only it could see the branch on the log that it was, it bypassed that branch, I didn't. And so my knee still bears the scars of this thing 40 years after the event. All here, I had splinters and stuff, and the people in the truck, my aunt and uncle, they were wetting themselves laughing, everyone else was laughing, and I was on the ground, blood everywhere and stuff. We got back, they picked out some of the splinters, they laughed, we laughed, and I thought that was okay. Because when you're 13 or 14, you're bulletproof, nothing can hurt you. Jumping into the unknown is just pure exhilaration, like your first kiss. Isn't it? Wasn't it? Can you remember back that far to your first kiss? Like, you'd seen the movies. You'd heard your mates talk about their first kiss, and you sort of tagged along, yeah, I've done that. You hadn't done it at all. You'd even played the scene out in your mind about how you would do that. The embrace, the tilt of the head, because you didn't want to bang noses, and the height adjustment, because if you're like me, a little vertically challenged, you had to work out whether you're standing on the gutter, in the gutter, or whatever. And so you work all of this out. And now the moment comes, your heart's beating fast, and you've asked yourself, would her lips feel like the dimpled skin on the orange that you've been practicing on? You all did that. And some of you are taking notes. I didn't try that, but that might be worth it. Because when you get a little older, exhilaration is tempered by a little reality. Like you move out of home for the first time to get your own place, there's the excitement and the anticipation of freedom, the freedom to come and go, the lure of being independent as an adult entices you. And yet there's a vague awareness of a certain reality that if you don't pay the electricity bill, the fridge doesn't work. That means food goes off. If you don't go and buy food, when you open the door, it doesn't magically appear in the fridge. Of course, others have gone before you and you're not the first to do it, but it's a step into the unknown, and with that comes a little nervousness. Like maybe when you proposed. You proposed to a beautiful young woman. Many have gone before you, but this is your moment. And in between the proposal and standing at the end of a church service in which you had said, from this day forward, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, I promise to have and to hold for the rest of our days, till death do us part. Around about that time, a cold sweat begins. This is the first time you've done this. You're not quite sure how the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years will pan out. It's a step into the unknown. And if you've been married before and you're getting married again, the cold sweat can be greater, can't it? Because you've been there once and you're wondering if this step into the unknown will turn out better or not. When I first came to St. Paul's, I used to park my car over here outside the office, and when the first footy season started, I used to watch the O'Kill teams train. And I'd get out there and pack my car, because as I was leaving the office at around about 5, that's when the teams were getting into the full swing of training for rugby union, and I found my body twitching. And memories, tapes playing, and my legs start to want to run, and my adrenaline would push, and I'd find myself saying, do they need a coach? Like, I could coach them. They have an old boys team. Maybe I could play in the old boys team. And I twitch. Nowadays, I see my body doesn't twitch, nothing happens. And that's partly because I know that I have enough aches and pains from my first run through rugby and rugby union, and it was just, I don't need any more. When I was young and bulletproof, it was all fine, but now I'm not young and I'm not bulletproof, the aches and pains are coming, and it's not worth the risk. I don't want to run into that unknown anymore. That's why we seek adventure in movies, isn't it? But the other day, I took my daughter to see Safe House, which is a cracking movie if you like action and a story. There's one in there somewhere, but the action's just brilliant. The story's not bad either. We were sitting there, and in the middle of the day, I thought, oh, here we go, with some older citizens. Teenagers and older citizens, not good to have in the movies. One lot talk incessantly, the other one want to find out what happened 5 minutes ago in the movie. Just goes on and on. Anyway, we're seeing in a movie, and I noticed that a number of the older citizens of Castle Hill were really getting into it. They nearly threw a shoulder or two out in the punching scenes because they were going for it as well. But that's as close as they want to get to stepping into the unknown. We are in a series called Run. We're looking at the last few chapters of Hebrews, written to a people who are not sure that they want to run into the unknown anymore. They're no longer bulletproof. They bear scars from having followed Jesus for so many years now. Stepping out of their comfort zone is no longer attractive. Long days at work and hours spent travelling in congested cities take their toll, and you don't have the energy left nor the will to keep living for Jesus on the edge. At least not like you did once when you were a university student, because when you're a university student, there was passion in your belly. That's when we stood up and we took stands against tutors and lecturers. We did that with abandon. We played our part once. Passion is for the young, not for us, right? But Jesus is after people who will run into the unknown. Hebrews takes us into an Olympic stadium, you may recall. Hebrews 12:1 says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, the idea is we've come in onto the racetrack. We are not spectators. Our time to be spectators will come, but for now we are on the racetrack. And all around us are there those who have run before. And you look into the crowd, you can see this great cloud of witnesses. You see Abraham and you see Moses and you see Joshua. You see Deborah and Mary and Lydia. They all have their seats in the stands because they have run their race. Now they have their seat and they speak to us. They bring wisdom for our race to instill courage into us. And today the microphone is handed to one of the all-time legends of the track team, to Abraham, who calls out your name and shouts out, run! Run into the unknown. You run into your future. You run. You can do this. Run, he says. And like a true legend of the track, he offers some specific lessons that he has learned, which he learned from when he ran. And he says, these will help you. These will help you. To get an idea of what he might say, I want you to listen to his reading from the stands here as we listen to a reading from Hebrews 11. Thanks.
Starting with Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed, and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so, from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they'd left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us.
There are a number of things that Abraham says. I just want to land on three this morning. The first one is this. He says, run. You run like an alien. I wish I'd thought of that heading. But Keith Baker thought of it, and I've threatened to have him come up on the platform and demonstrate exactly how an alien might run. But I will have mercy upon us, not necessarily on him, and we'll just teach the Bible. Abraham is saying to us, run like an alien. You do that because this is not home. Go to the next slide, thanks. This is not home. I know this is all that you know, but this is not home. If we're honest, we know it's not home. Part of the week that I woke to is grieving. A man doing a Good Samaritan act on the Hume Highway was run down by a truck as it ploughed into him and the woman that he was helping. Part of the world I woke up to this week is horrified because a bus driver using hidden cameras photographed young women and girls as they rode on his bus. Part of the world to which I woke this week is devastated because a man who was married for 30 years walked out on his wife, leaving her for another man. Not a woman, but another man. You look at this world in which I live. It's stained with human blood and smudged with selfishness. And when you see that, you long for home. But this is not home. And it's as though there's a homesickness that is common to us all. Authors, poets, philosophers try to understand it, and they all agree that we're forever travelling but never arriving. It's as though we are exiles. And the Bible story tells us, well, yes, we are exiles. From the moment that Adam and Eve rebelled against God, we were expelled. We were made exiles on this planet. We were expelled from the Garden of Eden and out of God's presence. And since then, we as a human race have been on the move but never home. Abraham calls out, once you meet Jesus, your longing for home is only intensified because you have met the one who is building a city for you. You have met the one who is building a mansion for you. You are who is wanting to take you home. And where we live now, these are places, these are but mere motels on the journey home. So Abraham calls out from the stands, run like an alien, run like someone who knows this is not home. Like even when Abraham made it to the promised land, he tells us, he still lived like an alien. He didn't live like one who had made it home, which is fascinating. As good as the promised land was, as safe as it was, as much as God made provision in the promised land, Abraham did not set roots down in the promised land. The promised land was just another motel on the way home. You see that in Hebrews 11:9, where it tells us, by faith Abraham made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. Didn't set roots down. He lived in tents. Running like an alien means that you not only know that this is not home, but you're prepared to move into the unknown. In verse 8 we're told, God's called Abraham to move out into the unknown, to move from the city of Ur, to move out into the unknown. And Abraham moved in obedience. God spoke, Abraham did. There was no question in Abraham's mind. One of the great theological scholars of our country, Stuart Barton Babbage, had in his office four photos. I haven't got the four photos, but from what I can work out, they looked a whole lot like what we're going to see now. So this is the first one. This is the second one. This is the third one. This is the fourth one. Someone asked him one day, another theological scholar, what's with the photos? They're all of sand. Stuart Barton Babbage said, yeah, they're taken just outside the city of Ur. One looks north, one looks south, one looks east, one looks west. I have them in my office to remind me that when Abraham was called to leave the city of Ur, a cosmopolitan safe place, he was called to go into the unknown. And no matter which way he looked, it just didn't look very attractive. But God said, go, and Abraham went. How could Abraham do that? Well, verse 10 tells us, for he was looking forward to a city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. Abraham focused and fixed his eyes on the future, to be with God in God's city. His aim was to stay close to God. And if that meant hanging loose to life on earth, so be it. Much better, Abraham concluded, to be with God in the desert than in a fine house without God. Abraham says, you can run into the unknown because you know Jesus who is building a city, so run like an alien. Now, within a generation or two of the writer to the Hebrews writing his book to the Christians in Rome, a man we know as the Shepherd of Hermas found it necessary to preach Abraham's encouragement again to the Christians in Rome. And he said this, you know that you, who are servants of God, are dwellers in a foreign land, for your city is far from this city, Rome. If then you recognize your city in which you shall dwell, why do you prepare fields and expensive displays and buildings and dwellings which are superfluous? The person who prepares these things for this city of Rome does not intend to return to his own city, the one to come. To run like an alien will mean we'll not always think or live like the people around us, therefore. You know, as we age, we hear people say, you know, today's a good day. Every day's a good day, I'm upright. And we kind of laugh and chortle on with that, but I think, well, there's a better day coming. For those of you who sacrifice certain luxuries so that you can leverage finances that God has placed in your hand for his glory, you are running like aliens. Because the danger with all the wealth we have access to is this. We begin to think that this is home. But when you are generous with your money, when you forego something so that Jesus can be made famous, you're living like an alien. It means that to live like an alien means we're not going to be satisfied with the OH&S life in Sydney. or not being what C.S. Lewis calls half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us in the city to come. When we run like an alien, we'll not be easily satisfied with new houses or large salaries or the lifestyle that comes with these, but rather we will fix our eyes on him who is preparing a city for us. And so we will pursue Jesus. In the words of Hebrews 11:6, we will earnestly seek him. We will pursue him, to run him down, to make him our own. Or in Hebrews 12:1, because we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us strip off everything that trips us up and the sin that so easily entangles, and run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us, because we are aliens. If you know Jesus is building a city for us, then when he calls us to move house, to relocate to Western Australia, the Northern Territory, Queensland, or Nairobi, you know that you go to do his bidding. Some of you in here are being called by God to go work with BCA. You've heard the call. He wants you to be an alien, and so you should go. Some of you, God is calling to be more generous with the resources he's placed in your hand. Yes, that will mean you'll have to get out of your comfort zone, and your comfort zone will shrink a little. But that's what happens when you're sacrificial with his money. Because he knows he's given it to you. And he knows that money can turn your affections from him to money. So he calls you to be generous and run into the unknown. Abraham then calls out from his seat, you can run like an alien because God is faithful. Look at 11 verse 12 and 13. By faith Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who made the promise. And so from one man who as good as dead came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sea on the seashore. Abraham would say, God keeps his promises. He's faithful. So you run. I was as good as dead, he says. I was aged. I was beyond childbearing years. And my wife, she was always barren. We had no children. And God made a promise to me when I was 75. Count these years. 75. When I was 75 years old, God made a promise to me that I would have a son. Do you want to take a guess how many years it took for God to fulfill that? Just take a guess. 25 years. 25 years. When I was 100 years old, my wife was a little younger. We had our son. God kept his word. And I saw God keep his word in the birth of Isaac and then Jacob and then the 12 tribes. And that led to Jesus, your Lord and Master. And now the whole world has the opportunity to go home because God is faithful. He keeps his promises. And some of you have seen him keep his promises because you were once dead in sin, but because of the promise to make you alive, you've come to Jesus and you now live. God has kept his promise. You've seen him keep a promise to answer a prayer and your prayers have been answered. God keeps his promise. And he has a big promise yet to come, Abraham says from the stands. He promises to send Jesus back soon to take us home. To take us home. And God will keep that promise, Abraham says. So don't give up. Don't throw Jesus away. You know, it seems like a long time, but remember, I waited 25 years to see one promise from God fulfilled. Keep tracking with Jesus, Abraham would say. Keep pursuing him because God keeps his promise. And friends, this is such a pertinent word for us who live in a Google world. We want everything in a nanosecond. We want it here right now. The Bible goes on in Hebrews 11 verses 39 to, and following to tell us that Abraham and everyone else did not receive what they were promised. They didn't get to see the city that God was building when they walked this earth. But they kept pursuing Jesus nonetheless. There will come a day when we will all walk into the city of God together, the Bible says in Hebrews 11, 39 to 40. But Abraham and Isaac and Jacob didn't see the city of God, but they kept longing for it. They kept running like aliens. And so the Bible says to us in the words of Abraham, you keep running. You keep running. And those who do, verse 16, God says, I am not ashamed to call you my people. If you would keep running like an alien, I will not be ashamed to call you my people. And we need to pause for that. This is astonishing. We're used to thinking that it's us who are not to be ashamed of God, but here it is God who is not ashamed of us. Now, men, you know what it's like to have your wife say, I'm not ashamed of you, even though you tell those endless dad jokes. And if you, no response, maybe it's because you live for the day when she might say, I'm not ashamed of you, even though you tell those endless dad jokes. God is not ashamed of us if we run like aliens. Third thing Abraham says to us is, run and do not hold back. This is curious, friends. Look at verse 17 to 18. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. It's a strange piece in many senses. Abraham, as we run past him on the track, yells out this last instruction, do not hold back. You run full tilt. You recall, Abraham, 75, gets a promise from God, 25-year wait before the promise is answered, and sometime after he is 100 years old, Abraham is called by God to sacrifice the one who is the answer to the promise of God. If anyone thought running into the unknown was unattractive, Abraham knew. But God, we're told, decides to test Abraham. Was it that Abraham's eyes had fallen from the city to become focused on the promised land? Did Abraham's eyes fall from God to the son that God had given him? Had Abraham's affections migrated from God to Abraham's much-loved son Isaac? Did Abraham's affections fall from God to the gift of God? Abraham's not the only one to face those challenges, is he, this test? Years and years ago, I was on a mission and we asked people these two questions. What will you live for? What will you die for? I knew the answer should be Jesus. I was a trained pastor. The answer to every question is Jesus. But as I reflected on those questions, I knew in my heart I was not saying Jesus. What will you live for? What will you die for? It worried me until one day it dawned on me. My affections for Jesus had fallen from him to the gifts that he'd given me. My brand new car, my brand new computer, my growing professional library. And so that was a challenge right there. God tests Abraham to see if Abraham really did honor God above all else. And so Abraham takes his son, binds him with rope, lays him on sticks that will soon be set alight, takes out his knife of sacrifice, hand on his son's chest, draws the knife back, full measure, about to drive it into his son's chest. At that point, God calls out. No doubt there was inner turmoil in Abraham's soul right then, but Abraham took steps to give up even the precious gift that God had given him because he did not want to hold anything back from following Jesus and running. Abraham calls out, now I know that you will not hold anything back. And the rest is history. How could Abraham do all of this? Because verse 19 tells us that Abraham believed that God could raise the dead. And so he threw everything aside to run. Here's a question for you, my friends. What difference would it make if you knew, what difference would it make if you knew that you would be raised from the dead? What difference would it make? You know, we watch our heroes in TV shows like Rawhide. Do you remember that when Clint Eastwood didn't have a wrinkle on his face? Like Rawhide, or nowadays Hawaii 5-0. The heroes go in hard and fast and furiously. They get beaten up every episode, but by the next episode, they're miraculously reshaped back to their original condition. It's like they have a new life. What difference would it make at home, in your office, or at the gymnasium if you knew that the resurrection was real? What difference would it make? Or what difference would it make when illness comes upon you, or death stalks a loved one, or death casts its shadow over you? What difference would it make? A friend of mine who comes to one of the other services in this church told me that a couple of years ago he was diagnosed with a brain tumour. It was so deep in his brain it meant very invasive surgery. After the operation, they discovered it wasn't a brain tumour at all, but a life-threatening bleed deep in his brain, so serious that death was just a heartbeat away. As he went into surgery, he thought, what's the worst that could happen to me? He said, I could die. And as much as I do not want to leave my wife and children, if I die, I go home. And that's kind of exciting. That's pretty attractive. Knowing that the resurrection is for real changes how you run. It changes how my friend runs. His life is focused now. He knows that this world is not home and that God is building a city in the future for him. Abraham says, don't hold back. Don't hold back. Abraham says, all I had to go on was a belief that God could raise the dead. That's all I had. But you, he says to us in the 21st century, you who sit in Castle Hill, you who sit in a Christian church post-resurrection of Jesus, you have proof of the resurrection. Jesus rose from the dead. This is the one, according to Hebrews 12:2, who is the author and the pioneer of our faith, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith, the one who punched a hole between this world and the next to make it possible for us to be resurrected and go home. So Abraham says to us, so run. Don't hold back, even if it costs you everything, even if it costs you your security and your comfort. Run, he says. 10 years ago when I came to this church, I met a man called Trevor. Trevor was a new Christian. He told his story on the platform here one day. His story is this. He was the theological educator for the Mormon Church in Australia. He was the bishop of theological education in Australia for the Mormon Church. As he's preparing studies on the book of Romans, he was struck by God's grace and was wonderfully converted in a Mormon theological office. Do you know what that cost him? Everything. Everything. His wife left him. His children have nothing to do with him. All his business contacts shun him. He lost his job, his status, his home, his car. He lost everything. And so we asked him, was it worth it? His eyes got real clear, and he said, oh yeah, it's worth it, and I would not change a thing, because he knows that God is preparing a city for him. And so he runs like an alien. So Abraham says, run like an alien, run into the unknown, do not give up, because God is faithful. Do not hold back. You run.